Was ist gut? Ein Podcast des Deutschen Designer Club.
Die Überschrift der diesjährigen Veranstaltung der Munich Creative Business Week lautet Why Disruption Unleash Creativity. Das heißt, warum Disruption Kreativität fördert. Design Thinking, Design Management, Social Design, Design Disruption. Willkommen im Dschungel der Designbegriffe und natürlich willkommen im DDcast, wo wir bekanntlich versuchen, Schneisen ins Begriffsdickicht zu schlagen. Mein Name ist Rainer Gerusch. Laila Akarolo ist eine australische Designerin, Nachhaltigkeitsinnovatorin und Pädagogin. Sie ist die Gründerin zweier Designagenturen, Disrupt Design und Eco Innovators. Außerdem gründete sie die Unschool, ein Pop-up-Programm, das die herkömmliche Art und Weise, Wissen zu erwerben und weiterzugeben, durchbricht. Akarolo hat die von ihr sogenannte Disruptive Design Method entwickelt. 2016 wurde sie vom Umweltprogramm der Vereinten Nationen zum Champion of the Earth ernannt, weil ihre Aktionen einen nachweisbaren, transformativen und positiven Einfluss auf die Umwelt haben. Laila ist die Keynote-Speakerin der diesjährigen Munich Creative Business Week, die vom 6. bis 14. Mai, wie könnte es anders sein, in München stattfindet. Plattform für neue Ideen, Trends und Kreativität, fördert den interdisziplinären Austausch und macht Design umfassend erlebbar, indem sie über 9 Tage hinweg Fachleute, DesignerInnen, Unternehmen und StudentInnen aus den Disziplinen wie Design, Architektur und Wirtschaft zusammenbringt. Mehr Infos erhaltet ihr auf der Webseite mcbw.de. Ausrichter ist Bayern Design, das internationale Kompetenzzentrum für Wissenstransfer und Kollaboration rund um Design in Bayern. Zu diesem Anlass spricht nun mein Kollege Georg Christoph Bertsch mit Laila Akarolo.
Today we have Laila Akarolo from London. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
It's great to have you and it's great to talk to you because you represent what we would call a global perspective on design, don't you?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, originally I'm Australian. I've lived and worked all over the world. I have the pleasure of working with some of the biggest companies as well as organizations, not-for-profits in emerging established economies with the UN. So I'd hope I bring a universal flair to the power of design as a tool for transformation.
That's great to hear. So you're being perceived as a sustainability and circular economy provocateur. So what means provocation in the context of the climate catastrophe?
Yeah, well, for me, it's super important that we're always challenging the status quo and that we're working towards a future that is infinitely better than the past or the present, right? So we take all the knowledge and capacity that we've developed as a species and we turn that into tools and strategies that really resolve past problems and ensure that the decisions we make today don't become tomorrow's problems as well, which when we come to the climate crisis, that's pretty much what we're dealing with. You know, in the past, decisions were made that have resulted in a significant amount of carbon dioxide and associated greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, as we all know, causing disruptions to the natural systems, especially the weather. And, you know, perhaps at some point in the past, our knowledge of ecosystems and the way that the interconnectedness of nature affects everything was not as profound nor as, I would say, widespread as it is today. And so for me, the provocation is really critical. It's about challenging dominant ideologies, mindsets, perspectives, and ways of practicing and doing. And design is one of these tools that has constantly evolved to support society at the time that it's needed. You know, the Industrial Revolution leveraged our societies into pretty advanced places at the same time as creating a lot of unintended consequences like pollution and waste and social inequality. So, you know, my provocation and provocative approach is to really creatively challenge how we do things and why we do them. So my background is actually in product design and sociology. So I'm a very passionate sociologist as well as designer, and I love the human condition and how messy and wonderful we are when you look at cognitive science and whatnot. So I really think that it's about changing the way we do things today so that tomorrow is better, but also being willing to acknowledge that past decisions were not always the best. And so that's my kind of provocative approach to designs and sustainability.
So, but what is the benefit, let's say, of a sociological view on design and vice versa? Because it's just like bringing it in together with a genuine idea of interconnectedness or interdisciplinarity is something on one side, but what is the benefit of it?
Well, I'm pretty sure that design as it is today has benefited immensely from bringing anthropological, sociological research strategies into the design process. I mean, design thinking is essentially based off, streamlined approaches to understanding human behavior and experience. But at the same time, when you understand sociology, which is obviously about the economy, it's about human behavior, it's about how agents operate in an economic environment, it's about psychology and philosophy, and it's really about the human experience and how we optimize the world around us so that we can have a flourishing and thriving community. And so for me, when you understand it from that perspective, you're really looking at curiosity and questions, as well as bringing in the science and knowledge of how humans have evolved, how our brains respond to things. Like, we know that the fight or flight response is really critical in addressing environmental and social issues. So many leaders avoid responding to the climate crisis because of their own fear, and they're unable to acknowledge that they don't know something or they're genuinely concerned about the impact of climate change. And so they avoid it. And that's directly connected to, you know, the psychology and cognitive biases. So the richness and the depth and the perspective shifts that sociology and all of its subcategories brings us is profound. And I don't think that design could exist in the modern form, especially UX design and a lot of the modern design professions. I don't think it could exist without the influence of sociology. I truly don't. And so, but what does that mean for the future? And certainly, what does it mean for addressing some of these big issues like climate change? For me, the understanding the inner workings of the human being is fundamental. Also, when we're looking at the circular economy and the transition, it's a really big experiential design challenge. How do we get people to transform their relationships with everyday goods and services so that they are eliminating waste and lasting longer and regenerating nature, which is the goal of the circular economy? So where we really need the sociological understanding of how to influence and affect change as the foundations or bedrock for those types of design interventions. So yeah, I think they're intimately interconnected in a really wonderful way, and they help us design products and services that are frictionless and beautiful and cognitively delightful, but also sustainable and hopefully even regenerative.
So what, you're the keynote speaker at the Munich Creative Business Week in 2023 this year. So what is your statement on this annual motto? Why disruption unleashes creativity? So how is disruption connected with this unleashing creativity? So what is this about this kind of explosive, generative situation between the two?
Well, let me maybe just define my version of disruption. So I've created something called the disruptive design method, which is an approach to solving complex problems, especially social and environmental ones, using a combination of sociological understanding, systems thinking, and design approaches. So for me, though, disruption is not about intentionally disturbing a system. It's actually about understanding the system itself to then define where interventions will have the most likely effective outcome. So it is really about intention and integrity to change the dynamics that are already in play. And so we know, like, a lot of systems, whether it be our energy systems or social systems, they have a particular formula or process or procedure that's resulting in the issues that we're trying to address, like, you know, obviously climate change is another theme we can come back to. But so understanding the system and then being able to define the points of intervention that will then likely create a better outcome is the kind of approach to disruption that I take. So it's not about kind of messing things up or just stealing customers from your competitors. It really is a generative systems-based approach. So it really has to have that foundation for it to be effective in creating change. So that's my framing on disruption. And then when you bring in creativity, which I probably don't need to give any details to your listeners on the power and influence of a creative mind, but essentially creative disruption for me is coming back to that systems perspective. It's not just saying, here's a system, I understand it, I know where to intervene. It's to layer in the creative intervention, to know how to work and weave the kinds of solutions or provocations or designs that will actually get to that better outcome and transform the system into something else. So I love this quote that Buckminster Fuller has that I think he stole from Socrates, which is that in order to create something, to change a system, you don't use all your energy to fight the existing system. You just design a new one that makes the old one obsolete. And I feel like that's the power of creativity and design, is that it actually just designs new things that people naturally and organically move towards, which makes the old products or services or systems become no longer desirable. And so creative disruption is really about using your creative force, understanding a system and seeking to create outcomes that are better for you, for your company, but also for people on the planet as well.
So let's say in cybernetics, in second degree cybernetics, we understand systems as being in a way unpenetrable, just like you can irritate a system. So why are you so confident you can change a system?
Well, that's interesting, George, because you come from a cybernetics perspective, but there are multiple, just like in nature, any ecosystem, there are multiple layers of systems at play. The cybernetics version is a little bit like the obvious part of the system. It's not as nuanced, say, as the mycelian network under the soil that is sharing resources and communicating between the trees, right? Like there are different layers of systems. And certainly what we know from, different approaches to systems thinking, whether it be soft or hard systems methodology, that ultimately every system is dynamic, chaotic, and constantly changing. And so if you create a man-made system that is rigid and structured, that it perhaps isn't penetrable, like a computer system can still be penetrated by a virus, for example. But nature and the systems, like your body and my body, are both systems. We have a system boundary that's our skin. And if, you know, you come at me with a knife, unfortunately, that's going to penetrate my system boundary and I'm going to have some problems, I would say. So we're trying to understand systems from the theory of dynamic, constantly evolving and changing systems, which is nature, which is us, which is most biological systems. And we're looking to understand how human-created systems, whether that be a problem or whether that be a product, how we can transform them by understanding the depth and nuance of them. So it's really about exploring relationships before the obvious. And in, you know, systems thinking, we talk about the iceberg model and not looking at the obvious tip, but being the kind of diver who goes down underneath it. And at the very bottom, we always know that it's basically mental models or human constructs that are driving the way society is, the way the values we have. And so we're in a process of great transformation right now where people are questioning what the value of business is and how to ensure that, yes, we make products, yes, we make profits, but how do we do that in ways that doesn't actually destroy nature or is inequitable to people? So that's the transformation we see. And I have the great pleasure of working with some of the biggest companies and watching this transformation play out, which is messy, right? Transformation and change can be a bit messy. And we definitely have some big learning curves that we need to adopt. But ultimately for me, the systems mindset shows us that there is no blame. There is no need to control a system. We have to work within them. We have to work within natural systems, human-created systems. And of course, we have really interesting outcomes when we approach things from that way.
So what do you expect from this discussion in Munich? So you're going to give a keynote. That's for sure. That's the reason why you have been invited, in order to inspire people there. But what do you expect from a discussion specifically in a place like Munich, an industrial city, and very skilled and also very professional audience?
Yeah, well, I feel like it's definitely going to be a mixture of people from, management through to people involved in the product development design process. And so I'm excited by that synergy and that crossover. I think that creativity, you know, it touches all elements of business and society. And it's quite a powerful tool that, when used well, can transform everything, including government, society, products. So I'm excited by that that discussion, and unleashing perhaps some of the potential for creativity at this moment in time being used more effectively as an intentional tool of change when it comes to things like climate change, the waste crisis, or social inequality, which we know are becoming more and more polarizing as topics around the world, but also more and more important, especially for everyday people. And we've seen this big shift in society recently, what we call like the values-based economy, where more and more top talent within companies are choosing to change their company allegiance to companies that have openly expressed and are committed to doing more environmentally and socially beneficial things. So I'm interested, knowing the history of Munich, knowing it's like an amazing place for industry, what is driving change and transformation for these companies that are headquartered there, that are really based in this more industrial industry, and really seeing what kind of changes are afoot, because we still need products and services. We still need to have, a functioning and flourishing economy, but we need to do that in a circular and sustainable way. And that's really the future of business, and the big challenge business is trying to address right now is how to do that, how to meet shareholders' needs, but to also do it in a way that then means you're attracting top talent and you're maintaining that integrity, especially in Europe. I don't know if you're familiar with the facts, George, that there's been a lot of new legislation coming online in the European Union. And so I'll touch a little bit on that, because whilst, regulations is not the most fun and sexy topic to discuss, it's certainly going to be quite disruptive. The new corporate sustainability reporting standards, I think, will have a huge effect on companies and how they perform moving forward. So hopefully we'll have an open dialogue and we'll have some really great conversations about all the themes and topics that this Munich Creative Business Week is looking to engage with.
Well, I think that you should expect also people to be very open to legislation, because it's become more and more clear that we need frameworks like the European Green Deal, that we need the frameworks like UN7. I think it's even in the industry, people meanwhile understand how important these contexts are. But you are more than many other players on the global scale combining academic work with design activism. So what do you introduce from each side to the other side of the distinction, practice and academia? So, I mean, if you look at practice and academia, so how do you bring this together?
Well, so I left academia over 10 years ago. I got all the way to the PhD level, and I'm very grateful for the knowledge and skills that I gained from being in the academy. And I have a great respect for the academy, but I also find it very slow and not able to respond as agilely and constructively as being in the, non-academic world. So whilst I bring academic perspectives, I would say that I've been an entrepreneur for over a decade, and my entrepreneurial work, I founded The Unschool, which is an experimental knowledge lab for adults. We have tens of thousands of students who are people who are professionals practicing in their areas, and they want to rapidly learn these new skills, whether it be organizational change or the disruptive design method or the systems approach. And so in building these kinds of more informal schools and learning environments, I've been able to see the power that well-designed pedagogy has in helping people make transformative change in their roles. And actually, we're just launching a new company called Swivel Skills, which is specifically for corporations and corporate employees to help them respond to the changing economy by swiveling to sustainability and the circular economy. So I've long been, in this kind of intersection between using the knowledge that we get from the science and academic field, but applying it to the real world, and also messing with it a little bit, disrupting it, because I would love to see us de-siloing education. I have worked a lot with MBA programs, and I'm so shocked that when I work with a company, I'm all I hear is the need for expert advice and expertise from managers coming into the companies on, say, ESG or the circular economy or diversity and inclusion. But these are still not adequately in the curriculums of most MBA programs. Like, you can do a specialized program, but if you're going to do a standard MBA, surely you should be learning about this stuff, because this is where business is at right now. But the academy has quite a slow process of adopting the business needs. And so, you know, a lot of the work I've done is to be overcoming that by creating gap-filling educational tools. I've designed games and resources that are used all over the world. A lot of my curriculum and content is used in top universities to help fill some of those gaps. So, yeah, I mean, like, for me, I'm a doer. I want to see change, and I want to make things. That's the designer in me. So, you know, the academy, I love it, but it's just a little too slow for the type of change I want to see in the world. So I've always been very much just like, find a problem, learn to love it, make something creative, put it in the world, and then move on to the next thing.
So we had, as you know, we had Mariana Amatulli on our program in an earlier show, and she's very active in the UN context, as you are. And there are only very few design activists really diving into this kind of transnational organizational contexts. The title of our program with Mariana was, we called her the chief diplomat of social design. So what would your job title in this context be?
Huh. Well, I already have a title. It's kind of hilarious. So my role with the UN actually is, I was named Champion of the Earth by the United Nations Environment Programme in 2016, which is a laureate position. They give away 6 awards every year to people who are advancing science and innovation for sustainability. And I was very, very honored to receive that. And so in my role, it's like a lifetime relationship with the UN. But in that role, I've done lots of different projects. I have collaborated with the economics division to create a tool for sustainable lifestyles and living called the Anatomy of Action, which uses the hand as a mimetic reference. It's a campaign tool that's used around the world. I've spoken at Nairobi at the United Nations Environment Conferences around science-based sustainability, such as life cycle assessment, and also addressing the need for design and creativity to be brought into the solution set. I've also, you know, spoken at a lot of different UN events and had the great pleasure of helping to bring the role of design. And I would love to do that even more, because whilst the UN is an incredible organization, it doesn't have any specific division or kind of area where it is focused on elevating or utilizing design as a strategic tool in solving the problems that the UN is seeking to solve, right? So even the SDGs, they're a fantastic framework, but design touches all aspects of them. And so it would be fantastic if there was a UN division for design, and I would very happily be involved in that. I'm just making up my future job title.
And we all would profit from that, I'm sure. So before we get to our our famous final question, namely what is good, I would like to ask you about the differentiation and explain your definition of two terms that are being used very oftenly as synonyms, namely sustainability and resilience. How would you define, from your perspective, the difference of sustainability and resilience?
Yeah, that's a great question. So sustainability as a term, you know, has gone through a lot. On one hand, if you just look up the dictionary definition, you know, to sustain something is to be able to maintain it into the future. And some people argue that that's a really boring thing. But the term sustainability now has come to mean an overarching set of concepts and tools and techniques of minimizing and rectifying environmental and social damage through, whether it be business or through government, et cetera. And underneath that overarching terminology and framing, with 30 plus years of academic research, of industry development, we have a series of new approaches that have emerged. Some have come and gone. One is, you know, like corporate social responsibility reporting is now being superseded by ESG, environmental social governance. But circular economy has really come together when we were looking at cleaner production, industrial symbiosis, eco-design, those terms and concepts have all come together and coalesced under this fantastic umbrella term, the circular economy, that is really driving a lot of transformation in our industry especially. So for me, sustainability, it's a goal, it's an aspiration, it's a framework, it's a set of technical tools, and it is really a pathway to regeneration. It's a pathway to getting to a better outcome. And regeneration is about giving back more than we take. It's about ensuring that we as a species are actually able to leave a positive footprint on the planet rather than the negative one we do currently. And so it's a pathway to that. And so the term resilience to me isn't actually, I would say it's more related to a particular type or characteristic that individuals, systems, ecosystems, even products can have within that flow or that process. So to be resilient is to be able to take on something, and then often something that's kind of worn you down or affected you in perhaps not the most positive way, and then be able to bounce back, as we say, right? So it comes from the term of a resilient ecosystem is a system that can take the damage. It can be thrashed by a hurricane, and you know, nature in all its wonder can just boop, pounce back. And you know, after a snow, anyone who lives in a climate where for half the year the environment is completely covered in snow, as soon as it melts, suddenly flowers and animals just pop up everywhere. And you think, how the hell has that just been living in this climate? That's resilience.
Okay.
And resilience for the individual is to be able to hold hope no matter how bad things get. You know, it's about being able to maintain the possibility of something different, no matter how drastic or disastrous the outside world becomes. And that to me is one of the most powerful things that we can do as humans, is we can hold hope in a world that is otherwise considered hopeless. And so for me, resilience is really a tool that we can cultivate or foster in ourselves and in our communities, in our companies, but it is not at all the same as sustainability, because it's really sustainability as it is today is really a goal. It's an aspiration. It's a pathway. It's a technical tool set. And resilience is a characteristic of being able to get to those outcomes that we also seek to get to.
Well, wow. Thank you very much for these entries into the advanced encyclopedia of design. This was fantastic. I mean, this definition is, I would obviously advise everyone who listens to this program to go to listen to your keynote speech in Munich. But now we've got one last question. It's our famous, because the entire program is called Was ist gut or What is good? So, very general answer. So, what is good?
It's sometimes the most simple questions that can be the most perplexing to respond to. What is good? Let me start by maybe saying, like, well, because good is a word that exists in a very obvious polarity or dichotomy, right? So good is quite often in reference to bad. So what is good design? What is good health? What is good love? What is good life? You know, what is bad life? What is bad design? So I think humans naturally have a negativity bias. We can't help but have a kind of more of a focus on things that are considered bad because we're wired that way. And so it is harder for us to clock in our daily lives the things that are good. As a designer, when I encounter a beautifully designed thing or experience, it totally lights up all of my neurochemicals. I'm like, ding, 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 this is amazing. I love it. So for me, good is often a combination of experiences that evoke a particular emotional and physiological outcome that it triggers joy or triggers some awe or something positive, because otherwise there is no opportunity to determine if something is good, because good would only be a thing that exists in the physical state of the person experiencing it, which sounds so meta as I'm saying this. But I guess I'm saying it because I know what bad feels like. And so I'm trying to envisage myself as I'm speaking to you what good feels like. And for me, good feels like something that works beautifully, that brings you joy, that elates some sort of emotional response, that it doesn't have to last forever, but that there is a moment of kind of contentment with the experience. So that to me is good.
Wow. So thank you, Laila. Thank you for just like giving us all these insights. And also thank you for your very positive approach to design, and specifically for your work in the UN context and so on and so on. But I'm really looking forward to listening to your keynote in Munich, and I think it's really worth going there anyhow. But just thank you very much for having been on our program. It's a great pleasure.
Well, thanks, George. I got to say, you've got some good questions in there. You've really drawn out some very meaty responses. So good work on the question front.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to being in Munich soon and meeting other nice, challenging people like yourself.
Thank you.
So for having me.
Das war Laila Acarolo im Gespräch mit Georg. Ihre Botschaft: Es geht nicht darum, bestehende kritische Systeme, Services oder Produkte zu zerstören oder unsere Energie darauf zu verschwenden, sie zu bekämpfen, sondern darum, sie zu verstehen, um bestimmen zu können, welche Interventionen den größten effektiven Nutzen für eine Transformation haben können. Und auf dieser Basis sollte Design seine kreative Kraft nutzen, um Neues zu etablieren, sodass das alte, überkommene, einer lebenswerten Zukunft entgegenstehende, den Menschen nicht mehr wünschenswert erscheint, womit es eben obsolet wird. In der kommenden Folge, die für unsere Abonnenten schon wieder ab Sonntag und sonst ab Montag hörbar ist, nimmt uns unser DDC-Mitglied Poonam Choudhary mit nach Indien. Vielmehr geht es in diesem Gespräch hin und her. Von Deutschland nach Indien, von Mumbai nach Stuttgart und mitten ins Herz von Stoffen, Farben und Identitäten. Bis dahin, wie immer, alles Gute, eure DDCast-Redaktion.